Psalm 78, 12 through 31. In the sight of their fathers, he wrought marvels. In the land of Egypt, in the fields of Zoan, he divided the sea and let them pass through it, and made water stand like a heap. In the daytime, he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a fiery light. He cleft rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock, and he caused water to flow down like rivers. Yet they sinned more against him, rebelling against the Most High in the desert. They tested God in their heart by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the wilderness? He smote the rock so that the water gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he also give bread and provide meat for his people?" Therefore, when the Lord heard, he was full of wrath. A fire was kindled against Jacob, his anger mounted against Israel, because they had no faith in God and did not trust his saving power. Yet he commanded the skies above and opened the doors of heaven, and he rained down upon them with manna to eat and gave them the grain of heaven. Man ate of the bread of the angels, and he sent them food in abundance. He caused the east wind to blow in the heavens, and by his power he let out the south wind. He rained flesh upon them like dust, winged birds like the sand of the seas. He let them fall in the midst of their camp, all around their habitations. And they ate and were well filled, for he gave them what they craved. But before they had sated their craving, while the food was still in their mouths, the anger of God arose against them, and he slew the strongest of them, and he laid low the picked men of Israel.
I don't know if you've noticed, but some people complain about everything. Like this woman I heard about. She was walking on the beach with her little boy. And they were just walking down the beach having a very nice day. And suddenly this huge wave, gigantic rogue wave, comes and just breaks over their head. There's the foam, the wave goes out, and the woman is just sitting there on the beach by herself. She looks around and she realizes her son is gone. And so she just begins to plead with God, "God, please, give me my son back. This is my only son." And she pleads and pleads with God. And suddenly another wave, just as big as the first one, comes and breaks over her head again. And there's the foam and the waves, and it goes out. And there's the boy sitting there, sopping wet, kind of a bewildered look on his face. But he's in one piece. He's fine. She takes one look at him, and she raises her eyes to God, and she says, "He had a hat." Some people will complain about everything. Do you know people who complain about everything? This story from Exodus 16, and then we'll go to Numbers 11, if you want to kind of hold those two stories in the Bible there. There are a lot of complaining in these two stories, but there are a few differences too, and it's the differences that are striking. Exodus 16 tells us that as soon as the Israelites get out of Egypt, just after they pass through the Red Sea, not 1 month later, they begin to complain. 1 month from seeing what had happened in Egypt, and they're complaining. They're complaining at first about the taste of the water. The water doesn't taste good. It's bitter. God shows Moses a stick. Put the stick in the water, which he does. And all of a sudden, the water's sweet. They love it. Now, a month later, they're complaining again. And this time, it's the food. They miss the food of Egypt. We're going to starve out here in the desert, they say. It would have been better. Get this. It would have been better if God had just killed us in Egypt. Oh my goodness. Now, this might surprise you a little bit, but I have a little experience with complaining children. One of those times was camp. I always kind of looked forward to camp, but the ride over to camp was agony. Agony. So, we're on the bus to go to camp. How long are we going to be on this bus? How much farther is it? Well, it's 1 minute longer, you know, or less than it was when you asked the last time. Well, how long are we going to be on this bus? 2 hours. It takes 2 hours to get there. Oh, no, I can't stand 2 hours. You can't stand 2 hours for 5 days of fun? I miss my mommy. I wish my mommy was here. Well, we're not even out of the parking lot yet, okay? Just give us a break. Give me a break here. Complaining children, they really can drive you crazy. These Israelites, they would have driven me crazy. But God, what does God do? God rains bread on them. The bread of heaven. Well, they call this bread manna, which means, what is it? That's right. No, they call it manna. What? No, it's manna, Kathy. That's right. It means, what is it? It's manna. And they just go outside. That's all they have to do is to go outside and just pick it up every morning. And there's enough for everybody. And it tastes good, like honey. Well, if you had only one thing to eat every day, wouldn't that be a good thing to have? Honey. You can't store manna up. If you do, it's going to spoil. You have to trust God that there's going to be enough for tomorrow. But you can gather twice as much manna on Friday, and then on Saturday when you get up, it's still there. It's still good. You don't have to go out and work for your food that day, a day of rest. Now, if you used to be a slave, doesn't that sound like a pretty good deal? A day of rest. In Egypt, they had seen how the mighty Nile River had turned into a stinking stream. But here, God provides sweet flowing water in the desert. In Egypt, remember, hail and locusts fell and destroyed all their crops. And suddenly the Egyptians had no barley and no wheat. But here, in the desert, God rains down bread for His children. For 40 years, every day. Enough for everybody. There's no off season. You don't have to work at planting it or storing it up. You just walk outside and you pick it up and you pick up what you need for that day. Daily bread. Now, God knew that they needed to eat, of course. But the Bible also tells us that this was to test the Israelites to see if they would obey God, so that the Israelites would know that it was the Lord who brought them out of Egypt. It's like God is saying, stay close to me. I'll make the desert nourish you with bread that tastes just like the land that I'm going to take you to. Now, if you go forward to Numbers 11, it's 2 years later. What have they been doing over that 2 years? They've been camped around Mount Sinai. They received the law. They learned about the ways of God. Now the time has come to leave Sinai. And it's not 3 days later, after they leave Sinai, that they start complaining again. This time, it tells us that the rabble among them have a strong craving. Now, the rabble, kind of an interesting term there. We're not exactly sure. What does that mean? Does it mean just Israelite troublemakers? Or maybe it's referring to the people, and this is probably more likely, it's referring to the people of other nations, other people. Maybe some were Egyptians, maybe others were slaves, who came out of the land with them. Others came out of Egypt when they left. They were free too. It doesn't really matter, I don't think, which group it is. Because the rescue, the Exodus, it was always for everybody. But you notice, not everybody has the same level of spiritual maturity. The bread of heaven has become monotonous. And the folks that should be more mature, who should understand that hardship is going to be a part of this journey, who should have developed patience and a steady focus on doing things God's way, those folks are letting themselves be influenced by people around them who haven't fully committed to living out faith in God. And now they've got everyone complaining. This is what they say. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But there's nothing at all here for us to see now except this manna. Now, a couple of interesting things in that to me. One, there's nothing to see here now but this manna. Well, was the manna for looking at? The manna was for keeping you alive, wasn't it? And you know, through all this big story of them wandering in the desert for 40 years, not one person dies of hunger. They have enough. And the second thing in this, that what do you mean what you had to eat for nothing? For free? You think you ate fish for free in Egypt? You think you didn't pay anything for your time there? Have you forgotten how much it costs to live in the land of Egypt? There's always a cost when you live in a land of bondage. But God continues to give daily bread. However, you know, this time again, there's a difference. They're going to learn a little different lesson from God here. So God sends this flock of quail. And it tells us that the quail end up on the ground, and there are enough quail. They're 3 feet high. It's a pile 3 feet high that extends for miles around the outside of their camp. It's gotten a little scary now, hasn't it? At first, you know, the people are ecstatic. It says that they rush out and everybody picks up as much quail as they can by the basket full. And the amount of quail, it said nobody gathered less than 700 gallons of quail. That's a lot of quail. They spread them all out in their camp. Can you imagine that scene? What it looks like. And they start to have this feast. And then there's the scripture that says, while the meat was still between their teeth, the anger of the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. And since that time, we've called that place the graves of craving. Have you got a few graves of craving in your own life? You know those places in your past that you would look at and say, those are the graves of craving in my life. Well, why does God get angry this time? What's different about this time? I think it's because there's a point where faithful lament becomes rebellious murmuring. God asks for and accepts our complaint. It's kind of a hard thing to imagine, isn't it? But there comes a point where that turns. And all of a sudden, it's not faithfulness that we're operating out of anymore, but it's rebellion. Complaining becomes ingratitude and a lifestyle of ingratitude. You know, the desert isn't some kind of surprise twist on God's plan for these people. God is in control all the time there. God made the desert too. God is present with them in the desert, just like He will be in the promised land. It's also a place of testing. God allows us to be tested not for God's own benefit. God allows us to be tested for our benefit. It's where we learn obedience. It's how we learn obedience. It's where our identity as God's people is molded and shaped. It's how we learn to live in a promised land. We've tasted the bread of heaven. We've had a glimpse of the promised land. But who doesn't doubt when you're in the desert? The New Testament uses this story to reflect on the very nature of the church, who we are together. We have a tendency to see it very much individualistically, don't we? My personal desert, my personal troubles, my personal journey, God's way of working with me personally. The New Testament really kind of sees it differently. It's about us as the church and what we're a part of as the church. It says Jesus is the bread of life, which sustains us on this journey. Jesus is the new Moses, and everyone who follows Jesus is the new Israel. We've been led out of bondage. We're being led by a new leader, the one God appointed, Jesus. And Jesus is leading us toward a land where God promises to give us rest from evil and death, a place where there will be no more crying, no more tears. But in the meantime, while you're in the desert, sin and grumbling remain an option. And there are consequences for refusing to obey God. But when we listen to the Spirit of God and follow the example of Jesus, only then do we have what we need to pass through the desert. God can and will work in the desert. God has brought this new community of which we are a part into existence. That was His plan. It's a new way of life, and our role in it is to live out that life in the desert, in the wilderness that we find ourselves in right now. This world is not yet what it will be, but we have faith that God continues to love what God has made. God hasn't abandoned this world. God loves the world, and God is transforming us and creation along with us. Woody Allen has a short play entitled God, and it's kind of a play within a play, as Woody Allen often does things kind of strangely. And in this play, he's imagining a cast presenting this classic Greek drama. And during the play, the cast members are called on, and here's Zeus, the father of the gods. He's going to be lowered down from heaven into the play. People are all in tumult. They're confused. They're trying to figure out life. And here comes Zeus, and there's thunder behind him. And the actor is trussed up. He's got on this harness, and he's hanging from a wire, and he's descending. And as he descends down, the wire wraps around his neck, and he strangles to death. And they lower him down onto the stage. And the rest of the cast is horrified, of course. And they're looking around, and how do we finish the play? And finally, one of the cast members says, God is dead. Ad-lib the ending. Ad-lib the ending. The Israelites looked around in the desert, and they forgot their story. They believed only what they could see in that moment. They forgot about the mountain of bricks that they'd made in Egypt. They forgot about the dust that they were forced to eat. They forgot about the death that they experienced in slavery. They forgot how God had led them through the Red Sea. And they didn't believe that God would provide for them in the wilderness. This is part of the danger of the Christian journey for us, is that we'll be tempted to forget. To forget what God has done for us. To forget how God saved us from slavery. Slavery to sin and to ourselves. And it's then that we're tempted to rely only on our own wisdom and resources to ad-lib the ending. When we lose trust that God is present and providing for us, or that God's ways are going to be enough for us, we want to make up a story that seems like maybe this will be a better way to live. I know that that's what the script said, But you know what? It just doesn't seem to work right now in our circumstances. Our circumstances are unique. There's no other time it's like this. Whatever's happening in the world. So we make up our excuses and we say, we've got to live it differently somehow. It just doesn't work anymore. We'll ad lib the ending. We lose confidence in the way of the gospel. We need to refresh our memory too. We need to listen to this full story again. If we believe this story and if we have faith in it, let's act it out in our lives together. Let's agree to that. Let's commit to that together. That's what we're committing to here together. It's a very serious thing. We do not have the flexibility to go off script and do it our way. We can't ad lib the ending, especially when instead of being in a land of milk and honey, we're in a desert. But if we're faithful to this story in the desert, you know, even though God doesn't promise to remove all the troubles, He does promise this. These are good promises. He promises to spread a table in front of us in the presence of our enemies. He promises to break open rocks and give us water. He promises to help us find and share daily bread. He promises to transform death into life. And He promises to help us find a sanctuary right here in the middle of a desert. I'm glad I get to live out these promises with you. I really am. I'm not very good at it sometimes, and maybe you feel the same way. That's truly why we need each other, isn't it? So if you're here this morning and the desert is causing you to doubt God's promises, if you're doubting God's faithfulness because of what you've seen around you, and you just wonder, is the ending that I've been given here, can I still live it like this? We need you here. We need to be together on this, okay? We need to work together. We want you with us.